Reparations Task Force. I'm Tim Wheeler. I'm chair of SCJ's Freedom of Reparations Task Force. We work to ensure that our members and other journalists have unhindered access to information, environmental health, environmental justice, just to name a few topics. Anyway, what we're having here today is a little bit of a different kind of a session. It was billed as a roundtable. I view it as what I hope is a two-way discussion. We want to hear from SCJ members and journalists about their questions, concerns, issues, gripes even, if you have them, about access. And I think maybe there are a few. I've heard them. And we want to hear from the EPA press people about what they're doing to try to help us and some feedback on maybe how we can be more successful at getting what we want. So we view this as a discussion, not just a gripe session. And we also hope that we'll all be, you know, respectful, and I'm pretty confident that will happen. This morning, we're privileged to have with us EPA's press secretary, Nick Condit, and Taylor Gillespie, strategic communications advisor with EPA, who also works on communications in the Region 5 office in Chicago, from London, which is kind of an interesting issue. So I'm going to open them and just let them sort of tell you a little bit about who they are and how they work. And then I'm going to sort of, I've got a few questions lined up to ask. And then we'll open it to you all to speak now. I mean, if something comes up in the middle of the conversation, you don't want to forget about it, you want to bring it up, raise your hand. We don't have to stick to a real formal format. You know, wait to be called on. If you are called on, since we had significant EPA presence at our conferences. Want to start?
I'm happy to. Hoping folks can hear me if I move the microphone a little bit this way. So, I'm excited to be here. I'm Nick Conger, I'm press secretary at EPA. This is my second tour at EPA. I started in 2013 in the kind of towards the beginning of the second Obama term under Administrator Jim McCarthy at the time as the Communications Director in the Enforcement Office. So I have some very helpful, I think, background and knowledge about how program offices work at EPA and how they intersect with our Public Affairs Office. Because about halfway through that second term, I transitioned over to Jim McCarthy's office to be a Communications Advisor in the Public Affairs team. And the last year or so, cover transportation and environmental justice issues in the Public Affairs Office. And I went to work for Al Gore for 3.5 years as his communications director. Moved down to Nashville to be with him in his personal office down there. And then when President Biden won, I had the opportunity to come back to my background experience is more environmental advocacy than it is political communications. I have worked on a political campaign. I kind of deep and personal interest in environmental issues. And so first and foremost, that's my equity, my priority is to advance environmental protections. And I think that reflects much of the agency and our public affairs office as well. And I'll just quickly speak to kind of the approach that we're taking and the kind of philosophy that we have, and we'll be quick because I want to make sure we have good time for a dialogue here. Obviously, well documented how contentious and strained the relationship was. Number one was to reset the relationship between the reporters that cover us and what EPA is doing. That said, also alert to the fact that it wasn't just the previous administration. There are some long-standing challenges that SCJ has had and that reporters have had overall about access to experts, transparency, and engagement with press officers. And so, by no means is this just a previous administration problem. This is these are some long-standing challenges here. And to Tim and Sadie's credit, already took office outlining some concerns and some issues that you were all hoping to have been addressed. And I think we've made good progress to address a lot of those issues that are outlined in that letter. Shortly after we took office, we did a virtual session with Tim and Sadie and with many members of SCJ to just kind of hear folks out, understand these concerns, and express our desire and willingness to address them, and here we are a year later, and I hope we have progress to point to, but it is definitely a work in progress, and that is why we are here, not just on the panel, but kind of in full force throughout SEJ. So this reset has been kind of first and foremost to our approach, and the reset is really just about getting back to having a positive, constructive dialogue with reporters, picking up the phone and talking through issues. If you're not getting what you need, trying to do away with these back and forths over email and just having an honest human conversation over the phone about it. I did a lot of coffees with reporters. We did virtual sessions with some of the outlets that cover us on a regular basis, CNN News and Bloomberg Media. We did these virtual sessions early on to kind of just say we are here to serve both our equities at EPA, which is transparency, advancing the work we do, but also providing information to the public through the stories you tell and the reports that you write. But also, here to help you. We are honestly here to make your lives better and jobs easier, and where we are falling short, this is a candid and earnest desire to fix it and to get it right. And so we are here to that end. And
take
a second to call out some of our regional press folks. I know we met many of you all last night at the networking event, but they're kind of scattered here in the first two rows. And then Nick Conger is our press secretary. But I'm Taylor Gillespie. I split my time a little bit between the Great Lakes office and our headquarters office. I work on national issues, but I also work really regionally on the Great Lakes. And I'd like to just, it's been a really interesting time in EPA. I've been here for 2 years, so just a little bit under the last administration and then under this administration. Before that, I was actually really excited to kind of share forces network government, but more specifically to talk about, our approaches and really, some of the leadership that's been brought forward to be more transparent and to hear that feedback. So, Tim, I will let you jump into some questions.
Thanks, Taylor. This has been been in the business for, I just realized, almost 48 years. And I've dealt with a number of administrations, and I'll just sort of set the tone. It is something that's been a long-standing issue that's gradually gotten worse in terms of getting interviews in particular, and that's going to probably be the main one when we have our discussion where we're going to have a lot of talk. The last time I contacted EPA headquarters and asked for an interview on deadline and got the interview the same day. The last time that happened for him was under the George Herbert Walker Bush administration. So that part of the process has gradually deteriorated from a time when it was pretty open. You could contact and there would not be repercussions and get your information in a timely way. But let's start with... we sent Administrator Regan a letter that outlined a number of these issues. That was one of the ones we wanted to walk through, some of those things that would be addressed. But we also asked a number of other things.
The access issue kind of overrides much of it, and a few things we've done to help, I hope, facilitate better access is to update our website with the actual names of the individuals that are who work with the program offices that you can contact and reach out to ask questions. And so we've done that. I meant to mention this at the top. I sent out guidelines to our regional and program offices early on, which was largely meant to cut down on the layers of reviews and approvals that are needed before you can get on the phone or to do an interview. Some of that is residual, just protocols and standards that were in place from prior administrations that we are looking to cut down, and I think we have. But the upshot is that you need to get on the phone with a reporter and to have simple, straightforward conversations with them, and we need to facilitate that in a faster and more efficient way. That said, a lot has changed since the George Herbert Walker Bush. It has changed considerably. As I'm sure folks know, we're in a 24-hour media age. We are in a social media age. We have, I don't know what the data points are, but I can promise you many times over the amount of incoming press requests coming into EPA on a daily basis than we did in those days. It's also a very litigious environment that we operate in right now, whereas a lot of what we say and do is now being scrutinized and used in court proceedings and their names in print, so that their names ought not be utilized in litigation moving forward. And so a lot of what we have done and put in place is to be responsive to our colleagues' desires to have some help, frankly, and in some cases to not have their personal information as their names being used in print so as to be weaponized in litigation. And so we are mindful and alert to these concerns, and we have put in place, I think, new protocols and processes, I think, in the Ledger regions to kind of reduce the layers of reviews and approvals that are needed to this end, empower public affairs professionals to get people on the phone with reporters to hash these conversations out. And we're doing that more and more. I truly believe that. I think you'll see a lot more on-the-record interviews out there than at least in the past 3 or 4 years. We have a new resource that's up on the website right now called Experts in the News that just went up to our covering. If you have questions about who are the subject matter experts that are expert on that matter that are out there talking to reporters on that, and then you can click on a link to contact the press office to reach out to that individual to have those conversations. And so we're, I think, increasing transparency to that end. We are doing more on-the-record interviews. We have cut a lot of the red tape accordingly from the past 2 years, and I think we're making an honest effort to improve those processes.
And I would just add that, you know, I know that talking about having guidance written down from a federal agency, there could be some taboos around that, and I've been in a PIO where there was no guidance, and it was just this kind of verbal environment where, you know, even though it wasn't written down, we knew what the expectations were, and that made it so much harder to operate. So having this administration come in and actually give us some...
Oh, I'm sorry, Tim. Sure. You asked a specific example from your letter reading schedule. What I neglected to mention was going back, child posted on the website on a daily basis, and so you can see who he met with and when he met on the regular. So I know that was a concern. And, you know, this is a fishbowl conversation, and he sent out his fishbowl memo early on. And we are truly committed to that. Again, I recognize there are areas where we're falling short and there are some residual practices in place that we need to fix, but we are approaching that honestly, and that's the dialogue we want to have with you.
Well, I appreciate that there are written guidelines now. I mean, I know when we had this conversation, the webinar back in March or whatever, at that point, there were none, because I remember we asked. You did develop some subsequently, and I guess it was maybe it's on me. I should have been asking in between, but as we prepared for this, I asked you. And so this is to the public affairs people. I mean, they say, you know, you should try to arrange interviews when possible. And they also say you should send press inquiries to OPA, which is headquartered, right?
Right.
That pertain to current or active HQ-led policy pushes. Or have national implication, or speak explicitly to the Biden-Harris administration agenda, or require coordinated action across local regions programs. That covers a lot of what we want to ask about. We generally want to cover the news, and the news usually has to do with the administration's priorities and how they're being carried out. So, I mean, that sounds like it would be a sort of a fire hose of referrals to headquarters for approval to respond. Is that how it works?
We ask to be aware. We ask to be aware of what are not there to sign off or to approve much of that. You know, let's talk about how to approach this, because there might be something else happening in a different corner of the agency. We're a 15
regional office with, you know, this kind of guidance. It's really pretty easy to navigate, and I think many of our regional press officers would probably say something similar. It's pretty clear when, you know, a reporter reaches out and they say, hey, I want some information about a Superfund site in my local community. And I want to know, you know, what the soil testing is. It's something really, really specific. It's so easy to know that, like, we've got the right people in the region to answer how climate change is impacting something. And so, like, that's obviously going to spread across the agency.
Recommends, or doesn't necessarily require, staffing all interviews with a press officer or somebody from the public affairs office. One of my colleagues actually had two on an interview. What's the point of that? And does it sometimes require extra time to set that kind of thing up?
To answer your question is to be responsible. responsive to what our colleagues are asking for. Our subject matter experts and scientists are asking for public health, public affairs support basis. We are often doing very sensitive on-the-ground response activities, and so it's really important that we're providing accurate information to the public, and we're there to kind of make sure that that information is provided. We are not there to sanitize or to filter the information that's being provided to you, and I know that's a concern, and that's something that is, you know, something that still happens, and we are mindful of it and alert to it and working to address it, but the purpose is to be helpful. Purpose is to be helpful for a question will come at an expert that they don't have expertise around, and we can then take that question to another office or another program who does have expertise so we can get that question addressed in a timely fashion.
Yeah, and I'd like to talk about something that happened really recently. I think many of you might be following the drinking water crisis that's been happening in Benton Harbor in Michigan, and my feel is that we've been doing it to see if water filters are effective. And the leading lead scientist, his name is Darren, he reached out to me in the Office of Public Affairs and said, hey, you know, if you reached out, they wanted to do an interview, I'd be happy to talk to him about the study. And I reached out to Mike and I said, hey, you know, these are the times they're available. What other questions do you, what do you want to cover in this interview? And, you know, after talking with Mike, he also wanted to talk about policy questions, like, were we going to recommend to use filters in the city? You know, he wanted to know about funding, how much money the city was getting from EPA. And these are all questions that Darren would have been positioned to answer. We obviously could talk about the filter study, but not some of the other stuff. And so I was able to bring in our Region 5 Water Division Director to that interview. So we had two, you know, EPA experts, EPA scientists, so to speak, on this call, and it made it a much more fruitful discussion. We were able to answer everything. There was no follow-up that was needed afterwards. And it made for, ultimately, a better article. And I think that highlights why it's so valuable to have, you know, a PIO involved to be able to have that initial discussion with some of those questions. I think it really does add a lot of value.
Okay. Those guidelines you put out for the public affairs chat, are there any, and I should have asked you this before now, but are there guidelines for EPA staff in general about dealing with the media?
The only guideline which it was reflected in Administrator Regan's fishbowl memo is that we asked for folks to loop in and coordinate interview requests through the public affairs office. But we also point out, points out that we all have an obligation to inform the public through the press about the work, that is an expectation of this administration that we are transparent and informing the public by answering questions to the press.
I appreciate trying to sort of be the Obama administration, one of the associate administrators, when I tried to sort of make the point that it was EPA's job to keep the public informed about environmental risks. So we knew where we stood anyway. One EPA employee has recently relayed to us that been told to forward all media inquiries to the public affairs office. And that pretty much always results in an email, vetted email response rather than an interview. Is that still the routine? What percentage of interview requests actually get granted, you know?
I don't have a specific number, but I'm willing to bet that the percentage has increased over the year that we've been in office relative to the previous 4 years and the years before that. And I don't mean to be flippant about that. I mean that sincerely. I think, and as I said, I mentioned, like, you go to our website now, Experts in the News, we're starting to populate a resource where all of our on-the-record interviews are up there so you can see who the expert is based on that topic area. We're doing it more. I hope someone here can FOIA Nick Conger's emails back, written response emails. I hope someone here can FOIA Nick Conger's emails back to press officers saying, can't we just do a interview here on the phone, guys? And it's happening more and more. I know that. I'm sure you all have examples where that's not the case, and I'm here to talk those through. There are times where it's not appropriate to do on-the-record interviews because, as I mentioned, there are, you know, on-the-ground response incidents underway. There is enforcement confidentiality that's at play where a lawsuit is either pending or an enforcement action is operating in. I just want this to be recognized, at least, is that we're sued on a regular basis, and our folks are shell-shocked by that. And so a lot of these protocols are honestly in place to be supportive and helpful to them. Now, again, to your original question, I don't know what the percentage is. I'm happy to follow up and see if we can get a number percentage, but I'm confident it has increased in this first year of the administration.
Okay. Well, that leads to a sort of a process question. Do you all log in all the contact you get and how they're handled?
Taylor, you want to speak to that?
Yeah, I can. That would be a lot of reporting. So no, we do not log them in that kind of manner where we're like, you know, tracking every single one. I will say that I know some of the regional offices have started to try to track things and associate it with certain topics to see if they can, you know, identify trends and maybe be more supportive in that way, but not in an overall comprehensive way are we tracking press inquiries. But to speak to the total amount, you know, I could speak to the last month of the amount of media inquiries that I've got. And I would say by and large, over half of them were actually interview requests. At the time, we really are moving forward with something on background, on the record. You know, there are occasions where it is really convoluted. Like, it would involve, you know, multiple people across multiple programs, or, you know, we're responding in writing instead of, you know, putting someone on background or on the record. But by and large, we're doing a lot of interviews, we're doing a lot of responding and writing. But if that's something that you're interested in and wanting to do an interview, you know, just reach out to us. You know, give us a call at pressca.gov or email us, and we're really happy to try and make it happen.
Okay. I'll also quickly, sorry, say, if we don't go forward with an interview on the record, we're going to tell you why.
Yeah.
We're not just saying, no, sorry, tough luck. We're going to tell you why. And if you've gotten a response from somebody and you're saying, no interview, shrug your shoulders, call me up, call Taylor up, call Tim Carroll, Deputy Press Secretary, up, and let's talk it through. It is an honest effort to get that right.
Okay. I mean, I will, you know, maybe, does anybody have any questions or comments that they want to bring up now? I mean, I think it's, you know, maybe we just sort of start this conversation here. In the back here, you want to stand up, identify yourself?
Yeah, we go more on the Finance Journalist, the board, I think, we got four days on the Freedom of Information Task Force. And Mr. Conner, you've been stating a few times that you're responding to feedback from employees that they're afraid of having to make use of litigation. But there's also the possibility that rationale was used to suppress it, have to do with changes essentially in subject matter experts. Potentially, if they're going to say something, we're in search of factual information as journalists, right? So if you're afraid of getting sued for some factual information that's stated, that's not really your responsibility. You know, that's the judicial branch. So I don't really buy your argument. So I'd like to respond to that.
I'm not so much worried about getting sued about factual information. I'm getting sued about non-factual information or incomplete information or information that isn't entirely accurate on the ground at that moment in the world and printed in the newspapers or on TV. But there are, I think, legitimate privacy concerns there. Folks who are scientists and experts at EPA, it's not in their job description to do interviews with reporters. It's in their job description to provide information to the public in a transparent, or it's their obligation, it's our obligation to provide information in a transparent way, to provide factual and accurate information in a transparent way. And so that's why we have these processes in place to enable that. But it's just the truth that many are just very nervous about talking to reporters because, in part because of litigiousness, but also in part because of the environment that we're operating in, the social media age that we're operating in. Their names out there put them they're scrutinized, and they can sometimes can be put in a tough place. And so it's about information that can be sometimes, unbeknownst to them, not factual or not the most up-to-date information. We've had, I know Taylor, you were telling me this morning about an example where it got a little hairy.
Yeah, and I would like to just also, before I even give an example where it added a lot of value, is to talk about Manchester Engineer. And I think as management and as leadership have recognized this, one of the big things that's happened over the last couple of years is we've had, everyone knows, and one of the things that's allowed us to do is to rotate people into positions where personalities do mesh a little bit. And I think that one of the things that you are seeing is, and I can say this is from my perspective, is that we're really trying to match the right press officer with the right program. Each program has its own culture, and we're rotating people pretty frequently. So you may have noticed if you have reached out to someone in our air division and our water division, you may have a new PIO in that role, same in the regional offices, and that is really to try to line that up so that we have this really good relationship between like the scientists and the PIO that's there. But I got two really recent and examples of, reasons why it's helpful to have a PIO on the conversation. recently we did an interview with Alina Dorka. She's our director of the External Civil Rights Compliance Office. She's talking to Stephen Lee. Everyone probably knows him from over at Bloomberg Law. And he wanted to talk to her about some of the changes we're making in external civil rights and really good changes we're doing in this administration to move from being reactive to being more proactive. And as Lillian was talking, she's so good and she's so talented, but she kept saying civil rights, civil rights, civil rights. And as someone, who doesn't understand how it works at EPA, we actually have internal civil rights issues, so like EO complaints, and we have external civil rights issues, which is when people put in a complaint to EPA. And, I was able to kind of raise my hand and say, hey, Stephen, just to make sure that you understand there's two differences here between the types of civil rights and where they fit in the agency. And so it adds a lot of value. The other one, and this was a huge issue last year, and I know many of the Great Lakes reporters will remember this, there was a story about that came out with a headline that said it's literally raining PFAS in the Great Lakes. That was a headline article of a national news, and it was an EPA cooperator who went on the record to talk with a journalist about some preliminary data. And we had not been involved, our public affairs office had no idea. And this was, as many might know, this particular type of science and sampling that we're doing in the Great Lakes about rainfall collection and trying to understand PFAS, it's new. We haven't done accumulating in rainfall in a way that we're not seeing it in other water systems. And so now you have this headline, you have people really scared. It led to a lot of other media inquiries. And again, if we had had some level of coordination, we could have, at least made the point to say this is preliminary data. That didn't come through in the interview. And I think, when I spoke with her, she's like, I thought I was saying it. I thought it was an honest effort to say that, this hasn't been validated, it hasn't been QAQC, but it just didn't come through. And so I think those are just a couple ways.
Well, I understand that. I guess the natural impulse, though, may be just to say it's preliminary, we're not going to give it out now. And that's happened a lot. I mean, we had a case in point where a contractor was writing a report on plastic pollution. One of our reporters was on it. I mean, was actually attending the work session where they were talking about the report, had the information, and asked for an interview. The person was willing to give the interview, and then they were told they couldn't have the interview because the report wasn't final. We ultimately got the interview after we had, that may have been the one that the two PIOs present, and a EPA staffer as well as the contractor. So our publication can wait a week or two to get information and put it in our monthly print edition, though we also do daily stuff. But a lot of others would find that difficult to meet deadline when you're put into that sort of situation. Some other agencies have policies for their staff. I was recently sort of pointed out to me that NOAA has a public communications policy. It dates back to 2008. It hasn't been updated, but they're still citing it as current. And in that, it says the usual stuff lists public information about department activities will be made promptly, accurately, and completely in support of a culture of openness and consistent with this order and official duties. So this was access to scientific order. Department employees may speak to the media and public about their official work and freely and openly discuss scientific and technical ideas, approaches, findings, and conclusions based on their official work. And then it says later that if media contacts an operating unit's public affairs office to request an interview with a particular researcher, that office will facilitate it. Researchers are encouraged, but why not do that at EPA?
Well, I think we are. We just haven't articulated it as you are referencing from NOAA, but I think we are.
Our scientists are encouraged to basically talk to the reporters when they call up, or do they say, I've got to check with public affairs first?
I think they say, I got to loop in public affairs so public affairs can be part of the conversation, which is a policy that we have in place, yes, there. But I think largely our approach mirrors that. Again, we are putting scientists on the phone and doing interviews.
Okay. And I haven't had that many occasions of this, but when folks, you mentioned that they're reluctant to talk because they're afraid of being sued, more often what I hear is they're reluctant to talk because they're afraid that they're not authorized.
Yeah, and I think that's true. And I think, again, that's a legacy of past policies or guidances or expectations from previous administrations, Democrat and Republican. And we are alert to that, and this is exactly what we're trying to fix and trying to change with the guidances that we've talked about, with the approach that we're taking with our.
Question here. Go ahead. Please identify yourself.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Binger. So I've never really been able to talk to anybody at EPA. I've covered agency for 6 years. I don't think I've really talked to someone. And I think that, so recently, I guess I've talked to someone on the record. I've talked to scientists who said that they're not supposed to email about the topics that I write about, but they've been told not to email about those topics. And it becomes really impossible to get any information because they're creating records when they're with emails and things like that, and I don't really get to talk to people, so I guess it just makes it a really difficult situation.
For our recording, I suppose I should repeat your question since you didn't have a mic. Basically, you dealt with scientists who said they've been instructed not to respond with email, right?
That they've been, instructed not to email even each other about the topics that I write.
Oh, okay, so they're not communicated by email. So, you know about that? What's the rationale?
I do not know about it, but we should follow up because I want to understand that better. In their program office, if there is a policy in place that's specific to that deal, and because of the pending litigation or because of pending lawsuits, I don't know, but principles that we are putting forward and figured out, because that's not how, I mean, again, that's not reflective of the principles that we are putting forward at EPA to have a transparent dialogue with the press and with the public about it. But again, I'm sure there are times where it's appropriate where putting something in writing that is subject to litigation can be, challenging or concerning, and so there could be some legitimate reason for that.
And I would also add, just to give some perspective on the size, so in the Region 5 office in Chicago, for example, there's 25 public affairs people, and over, then even like the division directors or the managers, the section chiefs, the branch chiefs are so far disconnected from our office in public affairs. And so a lot of that legacy, like they might have heard something 6 years ago or, even 20 years ago when they first started at EPA, and maybe they even heard that from like a colleague or supervisor. And it's culturally hard to shift that narrative, even if we don't have those same guidelines. And oftentimes they don't even bring it up to their supervisors, who then maybe don't even bring it up. So it never even gets to our office that people have reached out to scientists and they're saying these things. So just like this example, I've never heard of it, and I don't know if it sounds like Nick hasn't either. So I would also say like that adds one of the reasons why it's a huge value to go through a PIO. So if you were to, come call me or call, email press at EPA.gov or any of the regional press folks, we could try to connect you with the right scientists, and we would make every effort to try to do that. Versus if you start with a scientist, you might hear some of those same things which just aren't reflective of our guidelines.
Go ahead.
Just to follow up, I did ask the EPA about this recently, and I just got a statement back. So I mean, I think that's just kind of the issues that I have is just that you end up with a written statement, and they say they don't address. There's about 100 emails that I've got, and just said we don't talk about what's in those emails. So,
Okay. Let's follow up on that.
Right here.
Cheryl Hogue with Chemical and Engineering News. Thanks for being here. I really appreciate it. I want to give a shout out to Kathy Millmore. I appreciate that you have put Administrator Regan's schedule online. It used to be that all the program office heads had their schedule, and I used to check the Assistant Administrator for Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention every day, and it'd be nice to be able to do that again.
Okay, that seems perfectly
appropriate. Okay, good. Cheryl Hogue would like to see the program administrator's daily schedule. And that is, you mentioned chemical safety and pollution prevention. That's been for with scientific integrity questions, and it's been a touchy area for media coverage. Right about the time the whistleblower complaints went in last July, chief of the staff in that office sent an email to everyone there saying, reminding them that they were not authorized to speak to reporters. Was there a corrected email?
I don't know if there was a corrected email, and that's a fair ask, and we can follow back on that. But it was not reflective of the policy that EPA has that all members of our agency should be engaging with the press. But they should be engaging with the press, and we should be providing information to the press in a transparent way, and that was not reflective of our policy.
And that sounds like a broken record, but if you ever wanted, if you were trying to reach out to scientists in that program and you were getting some sort of feedback that said, hey, I've got this window that says I can't talk to you, it's a great reason to like reach out to press.pda.gov, call me, call Tim, Nick, you know, there's so many ways you can get a hold of us, and we can really try to make efforts to connect you with those scientists in the field.
And if I can just address the, Friedhoff, thank you, Michal Friedhoff, who, another friend of mine, named Michal, has come in and is, I think a few days ago, in that office, and her approach and philosophy to addressing those challenges moving forward. But, you know, I know it's not a career scientist, but it was 4 or 5 on-the-record interviews, 6 on-the-record interviews that Michal did with the report. That was something that Michal wanted to do to kind of tell the story about how she is approaching these challenges in this program. It is one that is well-known. The program, the challenges that you're talking about, is well-known, but it is also high, high on the agenda of senior leadership at EPA to address and to fix.
I mean, I guess the question that comes to mind with that sort of thing is when you want to, and this goes back to the scientific integrity policy, I think, does public affairs have a role in the EPA scientific integrity policy?
Well, first and foremost, the policy is driven by our career team, and it is driven by scientists. So we are very alert to ensuring that it is not politicized, necessarily. The role I think we play is to make sure that we're communicating publicly the reforms that we are taking to improve upon scientific integrity at the agency. There are, again, a lot of documented violations of scientific integrity from previous administration, and we have, for instance, when the climate change website is taken down from the previous administration, I encourage people to come, and we use Twitter and our various platforms to drive people back to that website to become informed and engaged on the climate issue. We put out a climate indicator, market contrast from the way things were before. There were toxicity assessments that were scientific, there were violations of scientific integrity in the past. We fixed those toxicity assessments. We republished the new revised ones, put those online. So there are numerous examples where we are playing a proactive role in public affairs to communicate that publicly, but the actual work of restoring scientific integrity is done by scientists, career scientists.
And I would also add that anyone in this room is not getting our emails. Like, if you're not getting the press releases that Nick's talking about, there's one you can email us and we can check on our list to make sure you're getting them. But also, you can go to epa.gov/. There's so many that you can call that are talking about their efforts around scientific integrity on a really regular basis.
Before that end, I guess the question that would come to mind is if your scientists, if somebody wants to interview one of your scientists about the science around an issue, why does that have to require a loop in? Especially if they have published an article, and I don't know how much scientific publication your staff does, but if they have published research, why are they not free to talk about that without looping public affairs in?
Yeah, I mean, that example sounds pretty benign, generally speaking, and so I just ask to be looped in so that we can be helpful, so that we can listen in on the call, so that we can provide help in follow-up items, so that questions come up that aren't relevant or specific to that report, that we can then find who can answer that question so we can respond in a timely and efficient way, and to be aware. And our role as a central coordinating point in the agency enables us to kind of be mindful of what's happening across this huge bureaucracy that we operate in, so that we can ensure coordination and consistency across our communications. But not to filter, not to sanitize, and not to water down what you're getting from that scientist.
And not to slow down, to kind of highlight what that looks like. And the Office of Research and Development, they have their own communication staff. All of our programs have communication staff within it. And many of those communication staff in the Office of Research and Development have scientific backgrounds. They were scientists in their own, before they moved into the communications role that they're in right now. And what that really looks like in practice, what Nick's describing, is really an email from the communications person in the Office of Research, like a heads up and awareness. It doesn't slow it down. We're not interjecting. We're not doing anything that would hinder their ability to move forward with the research interview.
Of course, the pandemic has upended all of our professional lives in the sense that we haven't been able to meet in person for anything. Attend any press conferences in person, or many. Maybe it's starting to loosen up some now. But in the old days, in the good old days, You could go to a press conference. You could go to a public meeting. You could go to a scientific conference. And if you ran into somebody, an EPA official or a scientist or even a program manager or a subject matter expert, one sort or the other, you could buttonhole them. You could ask them to clarify something they said at the meeting. Or you could simply ask them what's up without having to go through public affairs. Is that forbidden now? I'm just wondering, as we loosen up again.
Not forbidden, nope. And, you know, I think in practice, there will be times where the EPA representative starts speaking at a conference without a public affairs officer there, and I encourage them to speak to reporters at the conference in the moment. And if you've had any instances where that hasn't happened this first year, I want to know that so we can fix it.
And just to give a real example of when this has happened recently, in Benton Harbor, we've been holding meeting fairs with the community and press at all levels, you know, Detroit press and Harbor press, national press, have been out there and they've talked to our community involvement coordinators, they've talked to our water division directors, our scientists, the state, all these people that are there, and there is no PIO on the ground with them kind of interjecting and saying, you know, this is what you need to say, or, you know, you can't have this conversation. Oftentimes, if they feel like, hey, I really don't know the answer to this, they'll refer them back to the PIO, but usually that's because they're on the ground and they're here in a more timely way.
But if that happens, are they required to contact NOAA and say, this report's on me at this meeting, that sort of thing?
We ask that they do. There's not a formal edict, but we do ask that they do so that we can be aware.
So, like, using that video
for coordination purposes, yeah.
And it is helpful. It is really helpful for us because we often do get folks like, you know, I'm going to put them back in touch with the same community involvement coordinator that I already know that they talked with. So it really is helpful to kind of have that awareness of, like, hey, this is who they talked to.
If you had a question, right here, that's you.
Dean Scott, Bloomberg Environment. We had, I don't know if Nick, if you were on the call, but our staff did the beginning of the administration. We had our team in Washington.
Yeah.
And I would say, like, reporters, that was very useful. It's kind of an obvious thing, but, like, if you ask them to do one of these, the obvious benefit of that is they remember you. You call, you're like, hey, is this something that's breaking today? I'm hearing it's breaking today, so you know. Because I've been doing this since George H.W. Bush administration.
Carter
administration for me. If you've known it long enough, you've seen like that you tend to forget the things that actually work, whether it's tension or not, that like even with the Trump folks were there, that kind of like, hey, I'm out here, I'm this person, they put a face in it. So anyway, I thought that was very helpful. In fact, we talked about doing maybe an update of that, just because the piece changed. My question has to do with sort of my experience in requesting interviews. I've actually had a decent response rate on the things I asked, but I think that's partly because I do policy stuff in Washington. So I'm doing like a new story of like, what is the big monuments coming to Superfund? A story that has people criticizing how fast the program is moving and all that, but I am able to get someone to speak to where we are on the National Parks list and all that. And that's very useful. The other thing, excuse me, that is not my primary use the guy that runs the Office of Environmental Justice. And so, although I didn't use that for a story, I was seeing a lot of stories where people were talking about just wanting to that beat or to the more common part of the group. So they're assuming, like, to see if there's an office. And if you had, there was some number, like, if you added everybody, including the region, there's like 80 people. Yeah. So when they're running stories, you're just like throwing around these numbers. Like, EPA is sort of this agency that has the lead on this with a group of 80, including the people of regional offices. And people are like, oh, there's. That's a lot of people I could ask to interview, but also for the public, right? So I think that those background, it's sort of something the way it works in reporters, like you ask for the real interview, and then they like cut you off the news, you think, by giving this background information. But of course, a month later, we got an on-the-record interview with them because they were comfortable with our background.
Right.
You weren't stupid, you were asking quick questions.
Right.
So I will say, like, if you make it known to reporters that you can offer background interviews like this, and if it, once you get a sense of what's going on, the person might be available for a later interview. It's just a really helpful
because appreciate that perspective. I mean, I will say it's very helpful to hear you outline that theme because, you know, to be honest with you, I guess I had this worry that reporters are immediately allergic to background. And to hear you kind of articulate the value of background from your perspective is helpful because from our perspective, it is empowering for our folks to know that they can do a 30-minute interview without having to worry that, again, their name might be used in a way that wasn't intended or wasn't, you know, how they don't want it to be used. But you're right, we do initial conversations on background, and then they're like, oh, I can do this, this is good. The reporter, you know, asks good questions, and I have a good rapport with that reporter, and then they're more inclined to do on the record. I want to do more on-the-record interviews. I want EK to do more on-the-record interviews. But background is a good kind of move to that end, I think. It's empowering, and it's still, I hope, and intended to provide what we're all trying to do here in the form of stories, which is ultimately, I think, and hope, what we're all trying to do here. Your perspective there, I think, helps with me thinking through, like, we'll start with on-background just to get both parties in a good, comfortable place, and then a follow-up on the record.
No, I don't recall this being done, so this is not necessarily I remember from another administration. But it occurs to me like that panel that we had from EPA yesterday, for some of us, I wasn't necessarily going to do like some value that is added to these ongoing stories, and it occurred to me, like, I spent a lot of time chasing Justice 40 as part of my beat, and I was thinking, like, it would be great instead of having to parse this stuff out when I'm on. I do something about the scorecard only once. And each time you update, do a story on, like, well, are they producing this thing? Is it of any value? What do communities think of the pace, right? You're having to go in and ask for the update on the timing of this. It would be interesting if you guys did, like, a background briefing that was themed more 30,000 feet, like, environmental justice, where we are at EPA. We brought in Carlton from the Superfund program, Olam, and this other person from here, and either talk on background or I prefer to be on record, but like give we can ask questions of like, well, what about this other thing that's promised? What's the timing on that? How, you know, are you guys in the meeting? Have you stood up this? What's going on with the budget? And I think because otherwise it becomes what we're doing is we're rifle shooting our stories, we're pitching stories to editors on a fairly narrow thing to say, like, are you meeting this promise that Biden has made? And we gather the information, and then the next time I write an EJ meets climate change type story, I got to start flying. I get your staff, the person on it. We'll get updated, and then we start again. And just, I think that would be helpful. So like, you guys can pick the things that you want to pitch as priorities. But to some degree, that we'd be able to have.
So if you would like to see them do some more periodic briefings,
yeah,
on pending programs where they stand, yeah, I mean that sort of begs the question: how many press conferences and press briefings have been held? I don't expect you to have a tally right now, but I'd be interested to know where they stand. Back here, another question I have.
Brett Walton with Circle of Blue. Just to reiterate, difficulty of getting interviews with UK staff. Sidelines here. Difficulty in getting interviews with agency staff. And interviews with staff are not available, and email responses are given. The default is attribute on background to EPA, which I understand not wanting to get a name out there, but we like to attribute, want to attribute a statement about agency preference and potential action to a person. And so when I get that person, and that just leads to unnecessary back and forth, the email over attribution. So I'd like to see,
yeah,
and I know I'm not alone in that.
Sure.
You're putting a name to a statement and not just to an agency.
Well, this is a question I maybe we can hash out a little bit right now. So we get, as I mentioned, a lot of press requests every day, dozens, and that's just headquarters and the regional offices get dozens as well. And we often get laundry lists. Questions, 7 or 8 questions. And the challenge is that not one individual has all the answers. And so that we're going to 4 or 5 different people and we're aggregating responses back. And it's not just kind of interview requests, as I mentioned, it's just like information requests to be informing the story. So we're getting information from like 4 or 5, 6, Mary, and Tintin as a spokesperson, but that's not genuine and it's not actually our information. It's, you know, so it's a challenge that I would love to figure out how to address, because the way we've been approaching it is its background is attributed to the agency because it's an aggregation of information from across different experts across the agency. And it's an honest, I just want to be able to give you what you need without it having 7 different names associated with it. And it's a little hard because sometimes Susan's information, Robert had a change to that. And so we've made it in a way that we thought was the most accurate answer to you. So we kind of default the background.
Well, it seems to me 7 names is fine with me.
Really?
Joseph?
Okay. Is that others' perspective as well? You want 7 names?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I would like to know where the responses are coming from, and not just a building in D.C.
Okay, that's
That's sort of. I think we've sort of broken with you. You're actually talking or hearing from the experts or the subject matter experts on these things.
Okay.
I mean, our names are on those pieces.
Yeah.
We're responsible for what's there ultimately, and when people come back and challenge us, and we say, "Well, EPA told us," they say, "What? Who told you that?" And you can't really say.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Over here, Tony.
Hey, Tony Barbosa, LA Times. I just wanted to follow up on what Tim raised about just, you know, ask you, Nick, to talk a little bit about press conferences and press calls, like how have you been handling those? There's been a practice in the past by different federal agencies of having, you know, background press calls where essentially, you know who you're speaking to, but that person is not speaking for attribution. And to us journalists, it's like akin to having a press conference with like the officials with bags of things, and can't like we all know who we're talking to, but we can't use their name. So, are you still doing those sorts of things? And can you just talk about like how you're approaching press calls? Because these are really important venues to be able to ask, you know, clarifying questions, follow up questions, and to get them on the record with names.
Yeah. When it's an EPA press call or press conference, we're doing a lot of press calls because of our virtual lives. When it's an EPA press call, I think 9 times out of 10, it's an on-the-record attributed to the person who's giving the briefing. I recognize some of my friends across other agencies and across other elements of our administration do more on background. I recognize that, but can't really speak to that. I can speak to EPA. When an EPA press briefing happens, sometimes it's often on dates when we put our press release out the next day, the next morning. But I think we're doing them more on the record. I take the point that you want them on the record so you can have a back and forth. I think another thing that needs to happen in a better place is that you don't just get one question and your mic is cut off. You have a chance to actually follow up on your question and have a dialogue with an individual. And so I'm alert to that as well. Tim's been staffing our press briefings. We're doing, I think, more and more. We probably should do more, but I think we're doing more. When we have a big announcement to make, we try to get the subject matter expert or the lead of that thing on a press call, either day of or day before, on the record. So we need to do them more. The administrator needs to probably do them more. But I with an individual and not just, you know, talking point responses on background. And so hear you on the recordness of it, and when we check back, when we come back a year from now, if not sooner, let's track progress on those kinds of things, and I think we should follow up on progress. Tim, do you have a point?
I just wanted to add that we're also working with the programs to bring back some of these press briefings on the record that may have fallen off in the last couple of years. Right. The most recent example was the Toxic Release Inventory National Analysis came out, and so we put that analysis lead on a press call. We had a really good turnout. It was probably 25, 26 reporters. Did a Q&A at the end. There weren't a ton of questions, but that was totally on the record. They walked through the analysis the day that it was released, so we're looking to do more of that. And that's not totally organized out of OPA. That was an Office of Chemical Safety Pollution Prevention organized program. They were like, can we go out and do this press briefing?
That's an absolute thing. The toxic release inventory, and we put the expert who has been in the lead in that inventory on the phone, on the record for an hour to do a Q&A to reporters. And the purpose was to inform, because it's a complicated tool. And it was like, let's get the tool up on our screen and like, here's how it works. It's like a webinar of sorts, but it was on the record and it was with the person who is expert in that tool. But I hear you on Justice 40 and on EJ to hold our, those are complicated tools, and these are like metrics, mechanisms that we're using to hold ourselves accountable to policy policy directives. And so I hear EJ screening, and I think the TRA is a great example. But on the record, having a back and forth and not being on background, I get that.
And I'll just jump in with one point that we, one thing that we're doing that's been, I think it's been really helpful. So I think everyone knows a lot of times with inspections, the inspectors can talk about the inspection, but people have questions. They want to know, like, what's a turbidimeter and what's a, you know, what are these really complicated things that we solve problems with? And so one of the ways we've been trying to work with our enforcement folks is to find maybe a neutral inspector, basically someone that wasn't involved in an actual inspection, but that could speak kind of generally to some of the challenges with, like, having the right people be available for interviews.
Do you have electric reporters go along on inspections?
We would love to, but
I don't even go on the inspections.
Our enforcement team really runs the show.
Yeah.
I mean, I've done those at the state level, and some of them were kind of amusing, including one where I pointed out a violation. Did you do a C? Do you...
Largely because the administrator was in France.
Did you do a budget briefing?
We did not, and that was largely because the administrator was in France. But it was, we heard from other reporters that, are you doing a briefing? Why aren't you doing a briefing? And it was a lesson learned.
Okay. Yeah, and the last one I said, and I think it was in the Obama administration. Did they even do them during the Trump administration? Tony, do you remember? Yeah, I don't remember. And during Obama, it was the administrator would come on, read a 5-minute statement, and then you would go for the next half hour getting background briefings and Q&A from the associate and assistant administrator. And people were not happy about it, but they didn't care. So, anyway, up right here.
Dinah Pulver with USA Today. And it's going around, people are trying to figure it out. Do you have any kind of ballpark time for how many days it might take to try to arrange that? Is there something you shoot for?
Same day is what we shoot for. I know we fall short, but same day is what we shoot for.
I don't think I've ever had, in the last 2 or 3 years, had a federal agency actually get somebody that same day, so that would be really terrific.
All right.
I also just want to say I appreciate you guys taking the... And just, he read the policy from NOAA, and I think it depends on the agency. Some agencies at NOAA are terrific about letting average people speak, and like you can call up any weather service office and the weatherman will talk to you. But other parts of NOAA, there's no way you could get, they you call and they're like, no, you got to go through the PI. So
yeah.
It's not just you guys, but I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that.
Yeah, no, to be fair, every agency has its challenges. And even the scientific ones, I mean, USGS is one that we deal with a lot. And at one time they were, to our thinking, were one of the most wide open agencies in government. And that's changed.
It just took me 4 days to get permission to interview a USGS scientist about something that was completely innocuous.
Right.
Sometimes they even wonder, but there's a predisposition to want to really be out front on things that are administration initiatives. But when you want to ask about something else, it comes out, you know, it's a little slower response time. And
I think if I can speak that quickly, I mean, I just want, this is not an excuse, but I want folks to understand our shoes. The EPA, especially in the Obama era, was just under attack politically on a regular basis. So I think there's a shell shockness from those days where, you know, we were oversight hearings galore, and in our social media age, you know, getting attacked on social media, and lawsuits upon lawsuits upon lawsuits. And then the Trump years happened, and we'll let that speak for itself. We are a year in now, and we're just really trying to kind of just shake loose some of the shell shockness from the previous nervousness about being under attack and being scrutinized to a T for every single little thing. And so these are the kind of things we're trying to, you know, address and break free from. But, you know, I just, again, and I know there's always going to be a natural tension between press and agency, and that's healthy, I think, to a certain degree. You know, we have priorities as well. We are trying to advance our messaging and trying to advance our priorities, and we have opponents attacking us on a regular basis. We have to be careful. And that's just the reality of the situation. But that's why at the top I started, like, I'm not a political person by nature. I'm an environmental advocate by, you know, my experience, and I'm here to solve these super serious and pressing environmental challenges of our time. And that's, like, the earnest drive behind mine, and I'm sure I know many of my colleagues as well. And I also have an earnest desire to cultivate a positive relationship with reporters. That's why we are here today. That's why we will continue this dialogue. I'm sincere about in 6 months we could do a virtual session, accountable to like actual tangible improvements, not just nice words.
Just to speak practically too, like some of the people that you all want to talk to are like some of the most demanded people in the agency. Like even for me to get time with one of our leading, like, the more time that you do have flexibility, the better chance of actually being able to get something scheduled. It makes a lot easier.
Okay. Well, yes.
Tim, hi, it's Mike Smith here. Just to let folks know, the Prairie Chicken bus is leaving in 5 minutes.
Okay, yes. And lunch is served. So I don't want to stand in the way of that.